Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our subject this morning is the ethics of money production. It is a follow-up lecture on the two previous lectures that I've given on financial markets and deflation. So I will walk over some of the points more quickly because this is ground that we've already treated on and focus on those things that are relatively new. And if everything goes well, we'll even have some time for questions, though this is questionable. As usual, we'll start off with a few definitions. So we'll do this rather fast, right? An ethics is a body of systematic normative propositions about a type of human actions. So what is a normative proposition? It's a should proposition. One should do this rather than something else. And there are different types of ethics. We've dealt with this or talked about this yesterday already in our panel discussion. And I guess Professors Long and Gordon have dealt with this issue as well, right? So there are utilitarian foundations to ethics. There are deontological ethics. There are biblically or religiously based ethics, different things. And in the ethics of money production, we'll bring in various considerations. We'll bring in deontological considerations, but also a lot of utilitarian considerations. So a utilitarian consideration is what are the consequences of this or that choice, this or that policy decision. And the question is, do I like that consequence or not? And so if I like it, then I have an utilitarian justification for that kind of policy. If I don't like it, then it's not a justification. Much has been written about ethical ways to acquire and use money. This is a very, very old topic, and it reaches back to the oldest testimonies that we have of human thought. For example, the Bible is full of references, and the Old Testament already full of references on how to acquire and to, well, use one's money. But the production of money has been neglected, although there too, right, we have some predicaments already in the Bible and also in older non-religious writings. But essentially, that's a topic that has been dealt with only starting with the Middle Ages, and most notably with Nicholas Oresme's great treatise on the alteration of money. I'll spell the name O-R-E-S-M-E Nicholas. And we have his book in Latin, Oresimus. And we have his book on sale downstairs, right? So there are various translations out, but the best one in the is the English translation that has been published in 1956. And based on this English translation, all other modern or current translations have been based. So the German translation is based on the English one. The French translation is based on the English one. And so it's in a book combining this text on the alteration of money with various other texts on English mint documents and so on. So Oresme was the first thinker who systematically thought through the problems related, the ethical problems, the moral problems related to the production of money. The treatise Alteration of Money concerns the question under which conditions is it legitimate for the ruler, for the prince, for the king, to change the coinage of the country. Now, if you think of it, changing the coinage in practice, more than often, so there were two objectives doing this, two main objectives doing this. One was to replace an old coinage that has been worn out. So because you have silver coins typically, and they wear out after some while. I mean, the coinage technology was not very developed by the 14th century when Oresme was writing. So it was necessary from time to time to replace the old coins with new ones. So it was just some maintenance operation. And the other objective, and unfortunately in practice that was more prevalent, was to substitute an inferior type of coin for the old coins that were better. What means better? Well, the old coin would typically have, whatever, let's say, 10 grams of silver or 4 grams of silver per coin. And then the government said, and this was called whatever, a shilling, Right? Then the government would come and say, well, we have now these new shillings that please everybody except on equal footing with the old ones. But the problem was that they contained less silver. And this legal act was then is known as depreciation. And so the government uses its legal tender powers to put an inferior type of coin on equal footing with a full-bodied coin or a coin that contains more metal. And the objective is, of course, to fill the public purse. And so the silver that the government does not put into the new coins, it can keep for itself, so it can create more coins of the same type and therefore spend more money. So in other words, we have here an inflation technique. Right? Depreciation was the standard type of inflation until the 17th century, approximately. And only then it was replaced by fractional reserve banking and eventually also fiat money, which are more efficient inflation techniques from the point of view of the government, but I don't go into this today. Right, so Oresme was the first person who thought this through, and the context, right, the historical context, the problem was that princes had started debasing the coinage or depreciating the coinage systematically starting in the 13th and 14th century, but most notably the 14th century. And this made Oresme, in fact, one of the very first economists. His text, it's just in print now, is whatever, some 60 pages, so it's very accessible, is in fact the first systematic treatise on an economic subject. So, available for purchase, and by the way, I think it's also downloadable on the internet. I'm not quite sure about this, but I think so. So I recommend to all of you, if you're interested in monetary problems, to study this text. It's one of the great documents in history. So Oresme condemned debasement, depreciation in all of its forms, right, and walked through the different techniques that are being used and different variants of the same technique and condemned it all, which makes for a nice contrast with today's economists who usually welcome any form of monetary expansion. Oresme rejected this monetary expansion, well, it wasn't called monetary expansion at the time, with an argument that is exactly in line with what Austrian economists would say today and what the currency school said in the 19th century, namely that you don't need an expansion of the money supply from an overall perspective, right? It just benefits one part of society to the detriment of others. So Oresme was a long excursion, right? So Oresme was the first theoretician who proposed an ethics of money production. And what I've done more recently is to try to update this and bring this into context with our present monetary institutions, in particular fractional reserve banking and fiat money. And there are very few things that are really new in this book. By and large, it's just a systematic presentation of all those considerations that have been brought up on the subject in the past few centuries. The book is, of course, it's available online. It's also available for sale. So please think of your family, friends, fellow students at home. Buy many copies. I'm ready to sign them. Especially if you pay me a beer or something like this. So in my lecture, of course, or in what remains of the lecture, I cannot cover the entire book, but I will focus on the following four points that you see here. We'll first talk about natural monies, or more precisely, we'll start off with the typology of monies. And the main point will be to argue, well, that natural monies are sufficient, right? You can operate an economy, even a modern economy, with natural monies. And natural monies, in practice, turn out to be precious metals. I mean, we cannot be absolutely sure about this. It's not a priori statement, right? But that's what would happen if we had a competitive economy. And that wouldn't be a problem. Quite to the contrary, it would be a very useful foundation for a modern, thriving economy. Then we will briefly consider the main alleged shortcomings of natural monies, essentially in order to refute them. and then address the two main deficiencies of fiat money. I mean, the first one is that fiat money expropriates, and the second deficiency is that fiat money is destructive, and both of these points are relevant from a moral point of view. So let's start off with some considerations of natural monies, and we'll start off with a typology of money. Typology with a guiding line is a moral perspective, right? I mean, Mises has a typology of money, money in the narrow sense, money in the wider sense. There's base money or money in the narrow sense, and then there are different types of money substitutes, right? There are money certificates, fiduciary media, all of this is correct. But what interests us is a distinction that is useful from a moral or ethical point of view. So the typology that I propose in my book is the one between natural monies, forced monies, and fiat monies. A natural money is a generally accepted medium of exchange that is produced and used under the respect of private property rights. So it's money that is being produced under respect of the general rules that are constitutive for a free society, and only those rules, so no special rules in the case of money. You have a competitive monetary order, right? It's competing monies. Everybody is free to use the money that he prefers, the medium, generally accepted medium of exchange that he prefers. Everybody is free to produce money, right? Individuals, whatever, families can produce their own money. It's very unlikely that would work, but firms can produce money. Associations, if associations are unhappy with what the firms are doing, they can have non-profit production of a good money. Everybody's free to do and provide such kind of services. That's a free society. Now, what kind of monies would we have in this context? Well, we would essentially have commodity monies. And among commodity monies, precious metals. Precious metals, simply because of their physical characteristics, they are most suitable for monetary service. And so they have the typical qualities, right? They are easily recognizable, have a high purchasing power per volume and per weight unit. They are malleable, they are divisible, beautiful, etc., etc. Credit money might also be a natural money, right? You can use credit instruments, maybe bonds or something like this, or maybe shares of a company. You can, although I doubt that this would ever become really a generally accepted medium of exchange, but it's imaginable. And of course, in such a natural monetary environment, people would also use money certificates, and so representatives of money that are fully backed by underlying base money. Now, then there are other. There's another type of money that I call forced money. Forced money owes its existence to violations of private property rights. So you see the distinction here between natural money and forced money does not run along physical lines, right? For example, you can have a forced gold standard, right? If you say, well, I'm using force to prevent the use of other monies, and other monies than gold, then gold would not be a natural money because the extent to which it is used and being produced is not entirely based, does not entirely result from the respect of property rights. So there's some aspect of force here. Forced money comes most notably in place once we have counterfeiting. Right? So there are no longer money certificates, but false money certificates. So you have some sort of a banker who says, well, here, this is a money certificate. You deposit your money with me. I hand you out money certificates. You can easily use them abroad. You don't have to carry around a lot of silver coins or gold coins. You just take the paper with you, but it's fully backed. In fact, it's not fully backed. So he's defrauding on his customer. In that case, so we have forced money. And, of course, in general, the same thing holds true for fractional reserve banking, Although in some cases, right, we can argue that there are institutional arrangements, institutional setups are imaginable that are similar to fractional reserve banking, and which would be legitimate from an ethical point of view. I discussed this in a 2003 article with the title "Has Fractional Reserve Banking Passed the Market Test?" has appeared in the Independent Review, but you can find it easily online, right? Just type "Has fractional reserve banking passed the market test?" So I won't go into this at this point. You can look it up or ask a question later if this the subject of fractional reserve banking is of interest to you. Finally, and most importantly, there's fiat money. So fiat money is a special type of forced money. The difference between fiat money and forced money is that fiat money is a force in an institutional way. And if you have a fractional reserve bank that operates without support by the government, well, it's just an isolated criminal, right? Just if you have an isolated thug on the road, an isolated robber, and so on. I mean, these things happen all the time, right? Even in a free society, would not be a society without crime. There would always be some wrongdoers. The difference comes once wrongdoing is supported by those who are supposed to keep order. Right, guarantee the order in society. If the government itself, right, starts sustaining and reinforcing robbery, of course you have a bigger problem than if you have isolated robbers. If the government itself starts reinforcing and promoting inflation, you have a bigger problem than if you have isolated fractional reserve bankers. So fiat money is institutionalized forced money and owes its existence to coercive government. It's fiat money that is of particular interest to us because from the point of view of society as a whole, right, there's no way we can prevent forced money by some sort of law or something, right? I mean, it's sufficient to have the general law, you shall not counterfeit, right? You shall not defraud on your customers. I mean, this is clear. There's nothing more that can be done. But in the case of fiat money, there is a choice, right? We can choose to allow and promote fiat money, or we can also choose to outlaw it and get rid of it. We can, for example, follow Ron Paul's proposition and say, well, get rid of the central bank. This is a big step forward in outlawing fiat money. Right? So this is something that one can choose. What's the case for natural monies? If you're Murray Rothbard, who made the case for natural monies? It's one of the most eloquent defenders of natural monies. So the basic case for natural monies is that, well, from the point of view, again, of society as a whole, the money supply ultimately is irrelevant. Society and the market economy can work with any money supply. So it doesn't really matter how big the money supply is. Now, this statement, it doesn't matter how big the money supply is, must not be confused with the other statement that the money supply should remain constant. It's not the same thing. So if we say the money supply is irrelevant from an aggregate point of view, it means, well, that $1 million money supply is just as good as $1.5 million or just as good as $800,000 money supply. So what is then the right money supply? Well, I mean, economists do not have anything to say about the right money supply, but we can say something about the rules that bring about, the correct rules that bring about the money supply. So if money production occurs under respect of the general rules that guide all other forms of production, well, then we can accept the money supply that results therefrom. And so as long as money supply occurs competitively, right, there will be a slight increase of the money supply. It's slight in the case of silver, for example, because silver wears out, so silver needs to be replaced. Silver has more industrial uses also than gold, and in the case of gold, there are fewer industrial uses, so by and large you have an accumulation of the gold stock, which is fairly slow over time. Right? So money supply in a natural economy, in a free society, would increase slowly over time. The important thing is, from an economic point of view, is that this production occurs competitively. That is, it is ultimately determined by the same forces that determine the production of any other good. The production of lambs is determined by profitability, the return on investment. So that's the ROI, return on investment. ROI rules, and ROI rules in all fields. And so it's not that we should make a fetish out of profit, but as we have learned from Böhm Bawerk and then from Mises, the ROI is actually what harmonizes the different fields of production. If in any field of production the ROI, the return on investment, increases, what does this mean? Well, it means that here the service provided by that good, or the value of the good relative to the cost of producing it, is higher than in other fields. So it's right, the good is underprovided, so to say, relative to the other goods, right? If the return on investment on lamb production is 15% and the return on carpet production is 5%, it means that lambs are underproduced and carpets are overproduced relative to one another. The same thing also holds true then for money, right? If money production provides only a 2% return, well, then it's underproduced as compared to, or it's overproduced as compared to other things. So less resources will be invested in money production, more resources will be invested in lamb production, carpet production, and so on. Right? So in a market economy, the mechanism of profit and loss, right, the ROI, harmonizes all different productive activities, right, and puts them into relation and also limits them, right, prevents that any one of them becomes too important, because then if it becomes too important, then profits will shrink and ultimately there won't be any profits, there will be losses. And so in a free society, the production of money is balanced, is equilibrated with all other fields of production, and it is limited. Now, we can justify this natural order from a moral point of view with different arguments about which we have talked a little bit yesterday, right? So then our natural law arguments of the sort that Murray Rothbard has proposed and that is traditional from Roman times, right? The Stoics are the pioneers of natural law reasoning. And has been maintained by the scholastics, or the Catholic scholastics in the Middle Ages, and is still being upheld today, most notably within in the Western world, within Christian circles, and few people also outside. Hans Hermann Hoppe, whom you've seen here, this is the dark night of liberalism, has proposed a different type of justification of property rights, namely argumentation ethics. So Hoppe stresses that all property rights originate in self-ownership, homesteading, production, gifts, and exchange, and that these methods of acquiring property can be justified without contradiction, whereas all violent forms of acquiring property involve performative contradictions, so cannot be justified. Now, let's turn to the alleged. So, right, the conclusion is natural monies do work and fit into the harmony and the general setup of a market economy. Now, let's consider briefly the main arguments that have been brought up against natural monies and which make up the prelude of a typical monetary class today, or a macroeconomics class, right? You always have some very brief explanation of why it is good to have a central bank, why it is good to base an economy on fiduciary media, on fiat money, something like this. Now, I consider those arguments in chapter 4 of my book. It's one of the longest chapters, some 30 pages or so, which provides some summary of the main arguments. There are a few other arguments that I could have considered there too, which I didn't do, and which will be maybe done in a second edition or something like this. Okay. We already talked about the contention that the money supply needs to be elastic to accommodate growth, so that is not the case, right? I mean, even if the money supply is constant, which it is not, would not be in a competitive economy. But even if it were constant, I mean, all that would happen would be that the price level would fall. Right? Simply the level at which both products and factors of production which would be exchanged on the market, that price level would diminish across time. That doesn't represent a fundamental problem for entrepreneurs, so they can very well deal with such an evolution. So that's not a good argument against natural money. Second argument, typical argument, is that hoarding suffocates the economy. Right? So you have evil people who are hoarding, they're one of the misers, right? Who are sucking the blood out of the economy, and something needs to be done against them. We cannot allow that they would egoistically hoard all this money, and then other people would have to suffer from declining prices. So it's good to have fiat money, or at least fiduciary media, right? Fractional reserve banks to balance this, right? Whenever somebody's sucking the money out of the economy, somebody else, some generous person in the government or elsewhere, substitutes other money for this so that there's no pressure on the price level. We've seen that this argument is wrong for exactly the same reasons that the first argument is wrong. And there's even, as I've explained to you in my lecture on financial markets, there's even something both very unhistorical about this, and also the whole tendency is, I think, is very evil. And because hoarding is, in fact, is the typical form of the poor man's savings. Right? It's the typical form of savings of people who do not know much about financial markets. Right? The cleaning personnel, the mechanics, gardeners, and so on, have no time to deal with financial markets. They save by hoarding money. And this works pretty well in a competitive natural economy. It's a fine way. It's not the greatest way of investing when saving, but it's a decent way, and it preserves wealth and value fairly well across time, right? You have some risk where it can be robbed and so on, but it's workable. And if you take this out by creating fiat money or some other forms of monetary systems that permanently increase the money supply and thereby debase the purchasing power of value, you take this out of their hands and you make them dependent on financial markets and the sharks, right, the credit sharks and so on. So this, right from a utilitarian point of view, is a very evil thing. So hoarding should precisely be rather encouraged rather than discouraged, so which is the case in a natural monetary system. Third, that's the point that we discussed 2 days ago. Deflation needs to be fought, and I explained to you that that was not the case because deflation does not confront entrepreneurs with insurmountable problems, and quite to the contrary, even in the most challenging forms of deflation, where it really creates massive defaults, even that can have a justification, both from an economic and a political point of view. A fourth argument, which I also address very briefly, is that sticky prices prevent market clearing, right? This is the variant of the deflation argument. Deflation is intolerable because, I mean, in theory it might work, but in practice we have sticky prices. And here the argument is of course not entirely wrong, because in practice, of course, prices are more or less sticky, right? But the important point is that stickiness is not a natural constant, right? It does not fall from the sky, right? It's not a natural law or something like this. Stickiness depends on, especially on the institutional context, right? For example, if you have unemployment insurance provided by the government, then of course wages become very sticky, right? Because rather than accepting a lower wage rate, people will just go on unemployment relief. If you tolerate mobbing labor unions, right? Then of course prices become more sticky, etc. But if there's goodwill on the side of everybody, prices are as flexible as all parties on the labor markets will, right? It's a matter of the will. And if there's a general tendency for prices to decline, well, people tend to get together and they renegotiate labor contracts and so on. They can set wage rates at a level that will equilibrate the market, that create full employment. And this is what we actually observe in practice. So sticky prices are a problem, but this it's one challenge among others, other things. And it's actually good in many ways that prices are sticky, are not perfectly flexible. It's a good thing, but they are as flexible as market participants wish them to be. So it's not a problem for natural monetary economy. Natural money does not allow for interest rate policy. What is interest rate policy? Well, it's the whole group of our measures designed to diminish interest rates below the level they would have attained in a free market. Now, this involves most notably increasing the money supply in order to to have a greater supply of loanable funds on the loanable fund markets and therefore diminish the interest rate. That's true, right? Natural money does not allow for interest rate policy. The other question is this bad, right? And of course, from an Austrian point of view, no, this is a very good thing, because interest rate policy, precisely to the extent that it succeeds, so it creates artificially low interest rates, screws up things, right? It creates intertemporal disequilibria. It's not a good thing. Right? It does not make society richer. We don't have more resources just because interest rates are lower. What we will do is to use the available resources differently, and we don't use them in a better way. We use them potentially, or in all likelihood, in a way that actually wastes more resources than would otherwise have occurred. So, bad argument as well. Natural money is not stable enough. Now, this might seem to be preposterous. I mean, if we look at present-day monetary regimes, they are not stable, right? I mean, we have, in the case of the so-called hard currency countries, we have inflation rates of some 3-4%, and the US is around 4%, the Eurozone is around 3%. Well, that's not perfectly stable. I mean, it's kind of stable, right? It's certainly tolerable. The economy can work with a 4% inflation rate, can also work with a 5% inflation rate or 10% inflation rate, right? That's not a big deal. Can also work with -5, right? Can also work with a deflation rate, not an inflation rate, right? -10 might also work, right? That's not the thing. True, natural money is not stable in the sense that it would assure that there's a zero inflation rate, right? The purchasing power of money would remain constant through time. That's not likely to happen. But, well, first of all, this is not what we have right now. Right? I mean, right now we have, for the entire 20th century, we always had positive inflation rates. So that wasn't stability. Therefrom we had various negative consequences that we already hinted at. The second point then here is that it is questionable whether it would be particularly useful to have a 0% inflation rate. And that was the conviction of the stable money movement led by Irving Fisher at the beginning of the 20th century. Right? Irving Fisher was a typical American, right? With all of his virtues. He was a very smart person, lots of energies, was a great entrepreneur, because he not only was a professor, he also organized an entire movement, not only an intellectual movement, also a political movement. We need to have stable money. The gold standard is not a particularly good money because, right, the increases of the purchasing power and decreases of the purchasing power. If you have increases of the purchasing power, well, all debtors get into trouble, right? You have a deflationary environment. The debtors have difficulties paying back the debt. If the purchasing power diminishes, well, then it's bad for the creditors, right? They are being robbed, so to say. So we need to have stable money. And we can have this only once we have a fiat money. Because only with fiat money we can adjust the money supply in such a way as to offset changes coming from the real side of the economy. Right? If there's more growth going on, then we can also increase the money supply so the price level does not change. If the economy reduces its activities, right, for cyclical reasons or seasonal reasons, right, then we reduce also the money supply, so the purchasing power of money always stays stable. Right? That was Fisher's idea. And the main things that we have to say about this is, these 2 points that I already mentioned. Well, first of all, in practice, it was a failure, right? Fisher did not, the Fisherian movement did not substitute a stable money to, at the place of the instable gold standard. And we created, with fiat money, we created a money that was constantly inflated over the 20th century and sometimes very strongly inflated. And the second point is that a 0% inflation rate, a price inflation rate, is not, from an aggregate point of view, is not a particularly good thing. I mean, it's not bad, but it's not better. 0% price inflation is not better than 2% price inflation or minus 2. We have no way to tell what is better than the other. For entrepreneurs, it makes no difference whether first of all, entrepreneurs are not concerned with the price level, but always with their individual prices, the prices for their products and the prices that they have to pay. It doesn't help you if the price level is 0%, but your prices will increase by 5% or minus 5. And you have to correctly anticipate what are the prices of your products. So for an entrepreneur, already for that reason, the price level is irrelevant. But let's say even if the entrepreneur could anticipate, yes, my prices are moving along always with the general level of prices, well, even then, I mean, it wouldn't matter whether the price level increased by 5% or diminished by 5%. Well, the entrepreneurial decision-making, the relevant thing is always, do I have a sufficient spread between my cost and my revenue? And that spread, I can have it or not have it wherever the price level is and whatever is the evolution of the price level. Okay. And this is something that Mises started highlighting and stressing in the 1920s, most importantly in his book on monetary stabilization and cyclical policy. It was first published in 1928. And then he would make the same points in some more detail in Human Action and Murray Rothbard similarly in Man, Economy, and State. So this is the place to look for if you have to write a paper on the merits of price level stabilization, right, inflation targeting, things like this. So from an Austrian point of view, this is not a relevant argument. A final argument is that commodity money is it a final argument? Commodity money is too costly. That was the classical argument of Adam Smith and David Ricardo, and they said, well, we can obtain aggregate gains for the economy as a whole if we substitute fiduciary media at the place of commodity money. Let's say we had before fully silver circulation in our economy, and now we allow fractional reserve banks, so fractional reserve banks create fiduciary media. Right? So then the price level in our country increases. As a consequence, our exports will be discouraged and imports will increase. So Smith and Ricardo say, well, that's a good thing. Because so what's happening now? What are we exporting? Well, we are not exporting our fiduciary, right? I mean, we're not paying with our fiduciary media. The foreigners do not want to have our bank money. They want to have silver. So we pay them with silver, right? Silver is leaving the country, and the place of silver is being taken by the fiduciary media. But in exchange, we get non-monetary goods. We get real goods. And so we, by selling our money, so to say, we can enrich, at least temporarily, we can enrich our society as a whole. Okay? Now, that argument has been at first accepted by Mises himself, and Mises later came back on this. So he repented his position. He said, I was wrong in swallowing the Smith Ricardo argument, because as a consequence of substituting fiduciary media for commodity money, and even fiat money for commodity money, well, we have to accept the cost of the business cycle. So fiduciary media introduce, right, this element of instability, so it's not a good deal. We cannot just accept the argument of Smith and Ricardo, right? All things remain the same. We have a lower cost, Right? We don't have to use this very expensive to produce silver money. We can use a cheap paper currency, right? And then otherwise the monetary services remain the same. What means there's no, it's not true that things remain the same. Actually, it's true. You save some money by substituting fiduciary media for commodity money. But on the other hand, you get the waste coming from the business cycle. Right? So all things considered, right, that waste is much more important than the savings that come from substituting commodity money. Many years later, Milton Friedman in the 1980s has published one or two very good papers, which I quote in my book on that subject. And Friedman pointed out that, in fact, commodity money might not be even more costly to produce than fiat money. So Friedman says, for example, the following, right? I mean, the whole argument presupposes that, in the case of commodity monies, you have all the mines, right? So there are thousands of people employed in the mines and heavy industrial equipment and so on, which is very expensive. And on the other hand, in the fiduciary fiat money regime, you just have, whatever, three guys running a printing press, right? One secretary, one president, and the guy that keeps turning the printing press. So this is way less expensive than the operation of the mines. But Friedman says, well, look, that's not actually true. I mean, look how many people are involved just with the work of the central bank. The Federal Reserve has more than 20,000 employees. And I can assure you, they don't work at the wage rates of mine workers. Okay. The German Bundesbank has more than 10,000. The French central bank has more than 10,000. I guess the Bank of England has more than 10,000. You add all of this up, I have difficulties imagining that so many people are working in the mines, right? And especially, again, right, they don't work at the same salaries. I mean, probably if you just add up the payroll, it's way more expensive to operate central banks, at least in their presently existing form, right, than the mines, right? Plus, you have all various other industries that spring up because you have a fiat money regime. Now, for example, think of the Fed watchers, right, and financial analysts that have the special task of analyzing central bank actions and anticipate future central bank actions. Very important for investment companies. What will central banks do? These guys don't work for nothing, right? You have hundreds and thousands of such people running around. So, right, it's... Even in monetary terms, it's not clear that right, the overall expenditure on commodity money is higher than on fiat money. And of course, the final consideration is always the one that Mises at least implicitly had brought up. Right, we cannot assume that the services provided by fiat money and by commodity money are the same, right? So Mises was, well, commodity money does not entail the business cycle, fiat money does. But, I mean, commodity money also provides an insurance, right? It's so-called an inbuilt and an inherent insurance against depreciation of the value of the purchasing power, which fiat money does not have, right? So it's like if you say, well, I compare two cars only in terms of the price, right? Both... The essence of a car is to bring me from place A to B, and then it doesn't matter whether I have a Fiat Panda. You don't have such things in the U.S., right? It's a typical proverbial European car. Right? It's probably big like this, right? So this, and so it's two persons who can sit in this. It's kind of a jukebox, right? With four wheels, and a lawnmower motor in it. Right, so this brings you from place A to B. I mean, it's true. And then you can have a Volvo, which also brings you from place A to B. So it's the only difference, right? I just look at the price. This is crazy. Of course we don't do this. Right? The services are not the same. They share one type of service, which is bringing you from A to B. Fiat money shares one type of service with commodity money, which is to provide the services of an exchange intermediary. But there are other things that they provide that fiat money does not provide. For example, insurance against depreciation of purchasing power, independence from firms, especially financial firms. Right? That's fiat money does not provide. Right? So fiat money, one cannot say that commodity money is too costly. Right? Even if we make a try to give a charitable interpretation of this point, cannot arrive at this conclusion. Okay. So the basic case for fiat money is, right, so right, there is no good case for against natural money. Right? Is there a case for fiat money? There are two types of cases that can be made for fiat money. The first one is that fiat money allows to repair the shortcomings of natural money. So here we have then right the mirror image of the points that we just discussed. Right? So we can leave this aside. The second basic case for fiat money is that it allows to stimulate the economy. And the idea is that fiat money, because they can be increased more rapidly, more strongly, more flexibly than commodity monies, allow for more growth than would occur with natural monies. The basic argument ultimately is always, I mean, there are various variants of that argument, but the basic case is always the same, right, that thanks to fiat money, because more spending occurs, people will sell more resources into the market. They will not hold back resources that otherwise they would have reserved for themselves. And the most important case is labor. So I work, or the typical person works, whatever, 8 hours a day. In France, it's slightly less. Japan is slightly more, I guess. And so anyway, so it's a certain number of hours per day, and if your employer or somebody wants you to work more, well, they've got to pay more, right? In order to incite you. Why is that? Because the other hours are reserved for yourself, for your family, friends, hobbies. We need to sleep also some hours per day, right? So if somebody wants you to provide more services, well, they've got to pay more money. So that's the idea here, right? I mean, we just pump more money into the economy, so which allows us to pay people more money. And as a consequence, they will sell resources into the market that they would otherwise have reserved for themselves. As a consequence, the economy grows stronger than it would otherwise have grown. Now, there are various ways to criticize this argument. There's also a moral case, for example, that you could make. I mean, what is so great about simply providing more resource, in particular more labor? I mean, let's say even if it were true, right? I mean, is this really morally legitimate? It's like, I mean, give you an extreme case. Why go through all this spending? Why not just transform the entire economy into a slave economy? Just say, well, I mean, now I'm your production czar or whatever, king. Or and I say, well, you work now. You've worked before 8 hours. Now you're going to work 12 or 16. I don't negotiate. That's a very much more straightforward way of doing this. So, and it's clear, it's obvious that, I mean, maybe we'll produce more this way, might be, and it probably will not be the case, but let's say we produce more. Would this be a desirable end? I don't think so, right? And it's more important, right? It's not just because you have a higher production of goods through firms and so on, as compared to the production that would occur within the household or just spending times on leisure and family and so on. And what's the subjective value? It's not because you have more things that can be sold against money that this is better than the things that you don't pay for. We do not know. The other main argument, this is the one that Mises proposed as early as the 1930s, is that, this actually doesn't work because in most cases in practice, because the wage earners would react, right? I mean, you propose to them a higher payment, but the higher payment comes not from savings, from an increase of savings, but from an increase of the money supply. So as a consequence, the purchasing power of the money unit is likely to diminish, right? You pay the people, and from an aggregate point of view, I mean, some will win, others will lose, but from an aggregate point of view, they will not be able to buy more things with this. That is, right, it works only as long as there's the illusion on their side that the actual payment that is being proposed is more than just more money tickets, but actually more real goods and services that they can buy with it. Right? Only then it works. And as soon as they realize that that's not the case, well, they will reduce their supply, or in other words, they will work only at higher wage rates. Right? So this does not work. There's another argument that then the professional economist typically brings up, which is to say that expansionary monetary policy demonstrably increases real GDP in the short run. And that's true. I will explain to you why this is so in a minute. Of course, this raises a question, right? And we also know empirically from empirical studies that there's no correlation between the expansion of the money supply and real GDP growth in the long run. Now, that's, of course, a puzzle, right? How can this be? This is one of the miracles of contemporary mainstream macroeconomics, right? For example, you find it in Gregory Mankiw's macroeconomics textbook, right? He ends on this conclusion. Yeah, in the short run, we can improve things, we can improve growth, but in the long run, we cannot. This is as close as you ever get to intellectual bankruptcy. Right? It's just crazy. I mean, if this is true, right, if you can improve growth in the short run, why not add one short run up to the next, right? I mean, short run now for 3 months, and I have another 3 months. So how can it be that at the end, right, after a year, after 10 years, I have not created more growth? How is this possible, right? And the error here is that, of course, mainstream economists neglect the capital structure, right? As we can learn from Austrian capital theory, of course, it's possible to increase your output in the short run. It's possible to increase the heating of your apartment in the short run if you burn the furniture. Right? That's the point that Mises made in a newspaper article. Yes, we can improve things. I mean, we are feeling cold. And Mises was feeling very cold after World War I, right? There was no coal available in Austria, right? There was no coal supplies. He was freezing in his apartment and so on, bibbering. And so probably he must have thought, yeah, maybe I should burn a sofa or something like this, right? So of course we can heat the apartment by burning the furniture. Do we improve our things from an intertemporal perspective? No, we don't. Of course we can have a great time if you don't spend any time at the university or in school. Make no effort, whatever. We have a great time, especially while we're young, we're healthy, and so on, right? If you look at this from an intertemporal point of view, right, you just hang out and have booze and whatever, girls, boys, when you're in your 20s, well, you won't have the same standard of living like the other guys who go to school and do these things in your 40s and your 50s. It's very easy. From the point of view of the economy, it's the same, right? If we, in the short run, we can increase output if we put all our resources in the consumer goods industries. Right? We can increase output, but we don't build capital goods. Right? So we don't build tools, we don't build intermediary goods. All the time that we spend on intermediate goods, all the time that we spend on building tools, etc., does not show up in our output. It will show up in our output later, but if our concern is only to look nice in the statistics, well, then we put everything in, right, in short-run production for consumer goods. Right? So it's possible, but it doesn't demonstrate the point. Right? So expansionary monetary policy can have this result. It can create a short-run increase of output, but it doesn't mean that that's better, right? That this is an increase of output or growth from a more long-run, medium-run perspective. Here, a very short summary, right, of the impact of savings as compared to the impact of fiat money expansion, right? This is something, this is a summary of the Austrian capital theory, only with business cycle theory with application to national accounting, right? So if you look at the left chart, right, the increase of the money, what is the impact of an increase of savings at a constant money supply? Right, we would spend less money on consumer goods, right, because we save more. And as a consequence, our nominal GDP would fall, because nominal GDP measures the monetary value of final goods, most notably consumer goods. Right? So nominal GDP would fall. Right? It would fall both in the immediate run, in the short run, in the long run. Final production might at first actually diminish because you spend more resources now on building up capital goods. Right? So output of consumable goods would diminish in the short run. So in the short run, real growth actually diminishes. And in the long run, then you get an increase of output, right? You're going to study, or you spend time on studying economics or whatever other useful accounting or whatever else, right? Then in the short run, you have less time to spend in the bars, et cetera. But in the long run, well, you have more time to spend in the bars and on the golf course and so on. And so real GDP would at first diminish and in the long run increase. Expansionary monetary policy has the opposite results, right? Nominal GDP increases, right, simply because there's more money spent all over the place, in particular for final goods. Zimbabwe had an enormous increase of nominal GDP, right? 5 years ago when they had their hyperinflation. Nominal GDP went through the roof. We had all these millionaires and billionaires, 8-year-old billionaires in the country, right? Because there's a lot of money around. Right? But that hasn't anything to do with growth. Right? So what you get then is an encouragement of production in the short run, but because you neglect the production of tools and of intermediate goods, your production diminishes, maybe not in the absolute, but at least relative in the long run. Okay. I'm running out of time. I need to accelerate. Fiat money expropriates. We know this from so-called Cantillon effects, right, which we have already discussed over the week. Increases of the money supply benefit the first users of the new money at the expense of later users. Now, fiat money is imposed on its users, right? And as a consequence, the Cantillon effects do not play out as in a market economy as a natural stimulus to producers, right? If you have natural money, right, then Cantillon effects operate as a stimulus to money production, just as, right, the fact if you're a carpet producer, the revenue resulting from carpet production goes first to the carpet producer, which is a natural stimulus to produce carpets. So Cantillon effects are also a natural stimulus to produce money, and that's constrained by the mechanism of the return on investment, as we have seen. Fiat money creates winners and losers artificially. That is, even if it's not justified by the ROE. Right? So some people gain excessive revenues and other people have excessive losses that finance those gains. So the natural constraints on money production are destroyed. Right? The monetary economy grows artificially relative to the rest of the economy and the financial markets with them. So such force, at least if you base yourself within the natural law framework or Hoppean argumentation ethics framework, cannot be justified. And fiat money therefore entails an unjustifiable and especially a massive redistribution of incomes, which is one of the most problematic aspects of fiat money. Finally, fiat money is destructive, right? First of all, because of the Austrian business cycle theory, as we have already seen during the week, right? Monetary expansion creates intertemporal disequilibria, so we are wasting resources. And even if they are not, we don't get intertemporal disequilibria of the sort that Mises described, we still get a greater fragility of the banking industry and financial markets as a whole. Fiat money encourages moral hazard in banks and financial firms, right? If you have a central bank that operates and provides unlimited liquidity to the markets, well, then nobody will hold any more liquidity, right? Because you can get it costless at the central bank. That's why I always tell to my students in Angers, so if something goes wrong with your studies and you need to become a robber, don't become a bank robber. Because there's no money in the banks. Right? Traditionally, the 19th century banks were full of money, right? I mean, therefore they had big vaults and so on, big and armed guards and so on. Today, there's virtually no more money in the banks. There's no money. And you look at the bank balance sheet, there's less than 1% money. All the rest is somehow invested. So banks are very strongly leveraged. They're completely illiquid and they're completely insolvent. Very low equity ratios, right? And why can they do this? Well, because the central bank creates conditions to bail them out constantly. So they don't have to do all the things that are somehow costly. They can concentrate on the things that bring in money or promise to bring in money. So they take excessive risk, or develop a healthy appetite, or maybe excessive appetite for risk, right? And run down all precautions because they rely on the safety net provided by the central banks. So even if you don't get intertemporal disequilibria as of the sort that Mises described, you still transform the banking industry and the financial industries with them into some sort of a powder keg. Right? It becomes increasingly vulnerable to even the slightest unforeseen events, and then you get systemic meltdowns of the whole industry. Okay, we can conclude. Wow, I by and large managed this. Good. 5 points of conclusion. As we have seen, natural monies are ethically justifiable. Right? They can be produced along with the usual precepts, legal and moral constraints of a market economy, of a free society. And natural monies work well in practice. It's another important point. On the other hand, fiat monies are prima facie problematic from an ethical point of view. Why prima facie? Because they're imposed. Right? If you force somebody to do this, well, that never speaks in favor of that measure. It always speaks against. If you have to force somebody to do it, well, why? Right? So apparently it's not useful for that person. Right? So the only way to justify it is from an aggregate point of view. Yeah, I mean, individually, you're pursuing your interest and you're going for natural monies, but that's not good from an aggregate point of view. Therefore, we need to make sure that the system is different. Right? But so the violence per se is problematic, is always problematic. Right? Now, the crucial thing is that fiat money does not provide any aggregate advantages, so it does not deliver the goods. Right? So we only have this force, but there's no advantage, no aggregate advantage. And quite to the contrary, there are actually aggregate disadvantages, right? Fiat money tends to entail more wastes of resources and greater waste of resources, and fiat money fragilizes the economy and creates greater political centralization and has various negative cultural and even spiritual consequences that I discuss in my book, in particular in chapter 13. That was it. Thank you for your attention. And I think we have some time to for questions, right? This is the Bernanke. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's the other way around, right? That in monetary policy, you say, well, prices are not downward flexible. Therefore, we need an increase of the possibility to increase the money supply in order to circumvent this obstacle. Yep.
So, in a natural money production, how would money producers actually make profit?
Well, you operate a mine. Okay, and let's say you pay a total of 1,000 grams of gold on your factors of production, salaries, tools, intermediate products, some equipment, and so on. This is your expenditure. And as a consequence, you get a product, which is the money itself. You get, whatever, 1,300 grams of gold. So you would have a return on investment of 30%. Right? That's how it works. Right? And then if the economy grows, so you get a deflationary tendency, right? That is, you would have to pay less for your factors of production. You might still produce the same output, so your return on investment increases. Right? So in a growing economy, there is a stronger encouragement for money production, right? Which partially offsets this deflationary impact. Okay, I've answered all your questions. I'm happy about this. See you later.